ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening. Welcome to PM. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Jagera people in Brisbane. Tonight, the frantic search for a missing five-year-old girl continues in Alice Springs. She hasn't been seen since late Saturday night. Also, 30 years since the Port Arthur massacre, victims of the tragedy are remembered. And the US President and the First Lady call for American comedian Jimmy Kimmel to be sacked for a joke he made last week.
Sometimes you wake up in the morning and the First Lady puts out a statement demanding you be fired from your job. We've all been there, right?
First, we head to Alice Springs, where police have revealed that missing five-year-old Sharon Granitz was seen holding the hand of a recently released prisoner shortly before she disappeared. She was last seen late on Saturday night. Northern Territory police believe she's been abducted. Investigators say they think Sharon Granitz is still alive, and they're putting every available resource into the search. Jane Barden reports.
By helicopter, drone and on foot, today a 40-square-kilometre search of Alice Springs for five-year-old Sharon Granitz continued for a third day. NT Police Director of Cultural Reform and local Indigenous leader Leanne Liddle.
Aboriginal trackers are being used. We've also got the assistance of the Land Councils, Tungundjeri Council, North Force. We've got the ADF and we've got lots of agencies supporting us to look for little Sharon.
Police have revealed that Sharon and her mother don't live in the house at the Old Timers Aboriginal Town Camp, from which the child went missing at 1:30 a.m. on Sunday morning. Officers say her mother put her to bed in the house at 11:30 p.m. They'd gone there to use the washing machine. Police Assistant Commissioner Peter Mully today gave details of why officers believe Sharon was abducted by a 47-year-old man, Jefferson Lewis, who'd been released from prison just 6 days before the young girl disappeared. He also can't be found.
We believe Jefferson Lewis has led the little girl away. I think he was last seen with the little girl holding hands at around about 11 o'clock at night.
Police say Jefferson Lewis was staying at the house and drinking at a party being held there.
There was alcohol being consumed at the camp at the time, and so he probably was under the influence of alcohol.
Assistant Commissioner Mully says police have taped off an area near the house where they believe the former prisoner took the child, but wouldn't say what's been found there.
We've located items of interest within that area, and that's why it's still being processed by Crime Scene and under investigation.
Some Alice Springs community leaders, including Maxine Carlton from the Tungundjeri Council, think a major search should have been started earlier.
It should be an hour. Alice Springs should have been in a lockdown. When everybody knows within an hour that a child is missing, things would have been a lot better.
Peter Mully rejects that there was any delay.
No, I think the team has done everything within its power. It was up and running very, very early, and the resources here as part of the search are really significant.
Jefferson Lewis's court record shows he served 5 out of the last 10 years in prison for crimes including aggravated assault and breaching domestic violence orders. Police don't think he has a car, but they're still searching Central Australian remote communities that he has family ties and links to.
We've had police in La Jamanu last night and Yuendamu last night, and we're pretty happy that he wasn't in either of those locations.
Leanne Liddle from NT Police says Sharon Granitz's family are distraught.
We're looking after mum and the family and the wider family. This is every parent's worst nightmare, and we've continued to provide that ongoing support to mum and the wider family.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese thanked everyone involved in the search.
This breaks the heart of everyone who hears about this story. We just hope that this little girl is found, that this ends well, and I thank the police and volunteers for the work that they're doing, and I think on behalf of all Australians, we want to see a safe return.
NT Alice Springs Independent MP Robin Lamley and her husband joined the search.
We formed a line and we combed the grass, which was very thick buffel grass. It was a very solemn and sad experience. The police officer with us said, make sure that you can see the shoes of the people next to you. But I could barely see my own shoes in the grass. So it was really concerning thinking that a child could be in the grass and it would be very difficult to see her.
What do you feel like with the town going into the search for the third day?
It's deeply troubling and extremely sad that something like this could happen in Alice Springs. And to be a part of trying to find her, I think, in what small way you can is important to most of us.
Assistant Commissioner Peter Mully says the force is holding on to a belief Sharon Granitz is still alive.
Our number one mission is to find her safe and well. But as you know, as time goes on, the chances of, you know, finding her alive and well reduce. So hence the amount of resources we have present here in Alice Springs.
NT Police Assistant Commissioner Peter Mally ending Jane Barden's report. It's 30 years to the day since the horrors of the Port Arthur massacre. Today, a sombre ceremony was held at Port Arthur to mark the anniversary. Survivors spoke of love and the legacy of gun law reform as they gathered to mourn the 35 lives lost that day. Alexandra Humphreys filed this report.
In the Port Arthur Memorial Garden, a steady stream of mourners pay their respects. The names of the 35 lives lost on April 28, 1996, not forgotten.
Leslie Dennis Lever, Sarah Kate Lawton, David Martin, Nolene Sally, Joyce Martin.
That day is etched in our memories in a way words can never fully be described.
Survivor Jane Schofield addressed this afternoon's small and sombre commemoration.
For those of us that were there, and for the families, friends and communities connected to it, life was forever changed. It was learning how to gain confidence in a world that suddenly felt unsafe. It was carrying the grief, confusion, guilt, and questions that we may never have answers to.
30 years ago today, a lone gunman opened fire at the historic settlement of Port Arthur, a former penal colony turned tourist attraction in what would become the worst mass shooting in Australia's modern history.
I stand here today not defined solely by what happened, but by the strength it has taken to keep going.
Jane Schofield also spoke of love in the face of darkness.
In the end, love is stronger than hatred. It is stronger than fear. It is stronger than evil. Love is what helps us endure, what keeps us real, and what helps us move forward together.
At 1:30 p.m, a minute's silence, to coincide with the same time the tragedy unfolded decades earlier.
I'll ask you now to take a minute's silence to reflect on the past.
Always remember, there's no place, no time for regret.
The devastating incident spurred Australia to introduce strict gun law reforms. It's a legacy survivors often point to. Walter Mikhak lost his wife and two young daughters in the tragedy. And in the depths of his grief, he wrote to then Prime Minister John Howard, urging him to act.
I still think back on that time, and despite being like mortally wounded by what had happened and felt let down by society, really, and the government, the fact that the government of the day in John Howard and also the Labor Party, Kim Beazley and the Nationals, unilaterally made that decision in 12 days, you know, it was, I'm not sure that we're ever going to see that again. That decisiveness, you saw John Howard at the rally in Sale with his bulletproof vest, and his language was not meek or mild. It was like, we're doing this for the safety of our country. And I think to have that as the legacy of that event and all those people who died that day and the people who were injured and the first responders is really important.
In a recent interview, former Prime Minister John Howard reflected on the communication he received from Mr. Mikhak.
I just felt if I didn't keep pushing, I'd let people like Walter Mikhak down very badly.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese also paying tribute today.
We think of everyone whose world was shattered by the loss of those innocent victims. We think and thank again the first responders, and we think of the broader Tasmanian community as well. We think of Walter Mikak, who channeled his devastating loss into a call for national action on gun law reform. And out of tragedy, it is important to remember that Australia is a better place because the Howard government and the parliament of the day came together to answer Walter's call.
A small source of solace for those caught up in one of Australia's darkest days.
That report from Alexandra Humphreys. This is PM. I'm Rachel Mealy. You can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. The federal government is once again picking a fight with the big tech companies, this time threatening to hit them with huge penalties if they don't pay for news content published on their platforms. The move risks annoying US President Donald Trump, a fierce defender of American tech titans like Meta and Google, as Oliver Gordon reports.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese addressed the journalists gathered at his press conference directly.
Your work needs to have a monetary value attached to it.
Under the government's news bargaining incentive plan, tech titans like Meta, Google and TikTok will be taxed 2.25% of their revenue if they fail to strike agreements with traditional media companies for the news content being shared on their sites.
It shouldn't just be able to be taken by a large multinational corporation and used to generate profits for that organisation, with no compensation.
The policy is the latest iteration of the News Media Bargaining Code, which requires tech giants to pay to display news on their platforms. In 2024, Meta pulled out of that code, ripping up its commercial deals with Australian news media companies. Former ACCC head Rod Sims, who designed the bargaining code, has welcomed the incentive-based scheme.
If they don't do a deal, they face a penalty on top of whatever deal they might have done, and they've got to pay that as a charge. So, yes, it's cheaper to do a deal than it is to pay the charge.
But he's disappointed that it doesn't include artificial intelligence companies, which often use news articles in their summaries.
So they've got a solution for search and social media, but not for AI. Hopefully, this will provide an incentive for AI to start doing deals, because hopefully AI will realise that if they're not doing deals, they'll get caught by something like this anyway.
Dr. Belinda Barnett is a senior lecturer in media and communications at Swinburne University and hopes the incentive scheme injects some money back into the Australian journalism sector.
And I'm also hoping for a secondary and perhaps arguably more important effect, which is that we start seeing more fact-checked content on our digital feeds.
The media expert is expecting blowback, particularly from the Trump administration.
I think we should all get behind it, support the government, support the media organisations, because they're in for a big battle when Trump and the digital platforms come out, all guns blazing.
In a statement provided to the ABC, a spokesperson for Meta suggested the scheme would not create a sustainable news sector, saying,
"News organisations voluntarily post content on our platforms because they receive value from doing so. This proposed legislation, which would apply to platforms regardless of whether news content even appears on our services, is nothing more than a digital services tax."
Google has also rejected the need for the scheme, saying in a statement that it ignores the commercial agreements it already has in place with the news industry and misunderstands how the advertising market has changed. Bruce Wolpe is from the University of Sydney's US Studies Centre.
I think Trump is very sympathetic to what the US companies are saying. He was very sympathetic to big pharmaceutical companies in America who don't like the PBS. And so I think there could be some confrontation over this.
The former Obama staffer says President Trump is famously critical of legacy media.
Remember how Trump reacted to when John Lyons of the ABC asked him a question about his family's finances on the South Lawn of the White House? He remembers these things. So when big tech is coming to him and says, "The Australia laws are hurting what we do, and you support us so much, Mr. President, we need your help right now," I think the president's going to listen.
Anthony Albanese didn't respond to questions asking if he'd spoken to President Trump about the new scheme, instead offering the following.
We're a sovereign nation, and my government will make decisions based upon the Australian national interest. We do that right across the board.
In a joint statement, media organisations, including the ABC, Nine, Channel 10, News Corp, SBS and The Guardian, said the government's draft legislation is a critical step towards securing the future of Australian news.
Oliver Gordon reporting. The Hollywood star Rebel Wilson has given evidence in a federal court case in Sydney, denying that she's ever bullied or harassed her colleagues, and has confirmed she sees herself as a champion of women. Rebel Wilson is being sued by another Australian actor, Charlotte McInnes, who claims Rebel Wilson defamed her in comments that she posted to her social media account. Our reporter Isabel Rowe is covering the case. Isabel, can you explain what's at the heart of this case? Why is Rebel Wilson being sued?
Well, she's being sued by the lead actor in her newest movie called The Deb. This is a young actress, new on the scene. Her name is Charlotte McInnes, and she is alleging essentially that Rebel Wilson defamed her by making up a claim about her being sexually harassed by another producer on the film, and then recanting that story to try and further her career with that producer. Now, the initial claim of sexual harassment centres around this incident that apparently happened at Bondi in 2023. It was an incident where this producer, Amanda Ghost, and the young actress Charlotte McInnes were at Bondi. They were having a swim. Amanda Ghost had some sort of medical reaction to the cold water, and they both went up to her apartment at Bondi to warm up. Now, what Charlotte McInnes has told the court was that she ran a shower, that Charlotte then got in the bath to warm up herself, and that Amanda Ghost then, at the suggestion of her and someone else who was there, got in the bath with her because that was a better way to stop this reaction she was having. She says that it was never an issue. She maintains there was never any awkwardness from her, but Rebel Wilson claims that Charlotte complained to her the next day and complained about feeling uncomfortable. And that is where this case has started from, this disagreement over whether or not sexual harassment occurred and then whether or not Charlotte recanted that story.
Rebel Wilson was in the witness box for much of today. What did she have to say in her defence?
Well, she was asked about a lot of the accusations against her of what she has done with this supposed complaint that she says was made to her. The allegations are that she posted about this on social media, that she accused Charlotte of recanting this complaint, that she even asked her PR firm in the US to set up a fake takedown website, or a whistleblower website, as they called it, to accuse this producer, Amanda Ghost, of being an Indian Ghislaine Maxwell and of procuring women. So Rebel Wilson was asked about these things. She was asked about whether she thought posting these sorts of things about women in her movie was mistreatment, and she said that it wasn't. She was asked specifically about a text message that the court was shown last week from the Agency Group, which is her PR firm in the US, where the boss of that group was saying Ms. Wilson wants one of those sites. Now, Rebel Wilson said today she couldn't explain why that was said, and in some pretty fiery questioning from Sue Chrysanthu, who is the lawyer for Charlotte McInnes in this case, she repeatedly denied having anything to do with requesting the website, with writing the website. The court was even played an interview that Rebel Wilson did with 60 Minutes last year, where she again made these denials. And Sue Chrysanthu said today to Rebel Wilson, that interview was a pack of lies, wasn't it? And Ms. Wilson replied, no. And she was asked, you instructed a PR agency to publish them, didn't you? And again, she replied, no. So she's been very stringent in her denials that she had anything to do with it.
The questioning also became pretty intense at one point when Rebel Wilson was asked about the meaning of the word embezzlement. What did that relate to?
Yeah, so there has been this sort of counter theme running throughout this, which goes some way to explaining what Rebel Wilson's thinking was here. And there's been this disagreement between Rebel Wilson and the producer Amanda Ghost and two other producers on this movie about money. And there has been these claims put before the court that at one point Amanda Ghost and her fellow producers tried to get Ms. Wilson to pay some extra fees to them. Now, the court has heard that the money was never actually paid because Ms. Wilson raised an issue about it. But what happened today was that Ms. Chrysanthu again sort of sparred with Ms. Wilson over these claims that they had tried to steal this money. And Ms. Wilson told the court that the producers had embezzled it. And Ms. Chrysanthu said, you know, are you serious? You're lying right now. You have no evidence that the money has in fact been stolen. She accused Ms. Wilson of engaging in grotesque pretense in the witness box. All of these accusations, Ms. Wilson said, were wrong. But Ms. Chrysanthu pointed to the fact that there had been no evidence put forward to the court that any money had been stolen, that any of that money was ever paid even. And so she's asked for Ms. Wilson's legal team to present those documents if they have them.
Isabel Rowe reporting. US late night host Jimmy Kimmel has hit back at Donald and Melania Trump's calls for him to be sacked over a joke he made last week. There's been a flare-up in tensions between the White House and the media in the wake of the weekend's alleged assassination attempt on the US president in Washington. David Sparks reports.
Very nice.
One of the biggest stars on American television has been under fire from the White House, and viewers were waiting to see how he'd respond.
You know how sometimes you wake up in the morning and the First Lady puts out a statement demanding you be fired from your job?
First Lady Melania Trump is furious about a joke by comedian Jimmy Kimmel in which he said she had a glow like an expectant widow. He made that joke on Thursday, and at the time, no one really noticed. But then on Saturday, the alleged attempt to assassinate Donald Trump shook Washington. And soon after, the First Lady put out a statement calling on the American Broadcasting Company to fire him. Now, Jimmy Kimmel is defending himself.
It was a pretend roast. I said, our First Lady Melania is here. Look at her, so beautiful. Mrs. Trump, you have a glow like an expectant widow, which obviously was a joke about their age difference and the look of joy we see on her face every time they're together. It was a very light roast joke about the fact that he's almost 80 and she's younger than I am. It was not, by any stretch of the definition, a call to assassination, and they know that.
But the president's supporters aren't laughing. White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt.
Who in their right minds says a wife would be glowing over the potential murder of her beloved husband? And having experienced what I did with the First Lady on Saturday night, I can tell you that she was anything but that. This kind of rhetoric about the President, the First Lady, and his supporters is completely deranged, and it's unbelievable that the American people are consuming it night after night after night.
Meanwhile, the investigation into the alleged assassination attempt continues. It happened at the White House Correspondents Association dinner, and the accused gunman, 31-year-old Cole Thomas Allen, is facing several charges, including attempting to assassinate the US president. Janine Pirro is U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia.
There will be additional charges as this investigation continues to unfold. But make no mistake, this was an attempted assassination of the President of the United States.
From the Australian point of view, there was a major diplomatic announcement from the White House today. The President has nominated former Republican Congressman for Virginia, David Bratt, as his pick to become the next U.S. ambassador to Australia. Considered a staunch conservative and a supporter of President Trump's Make America Great Again approach, he rose to fame in 2014, beating a fellow Republican in a primary to take his place in Congress.
I'm just humbled that the people spoke, and I think they want a new direction in Washington, D.C.
David Bratt lost his place in Congress in 2018. He's been an economics professor and a media commentator, including multiple appearances on the podcast of fellow MAGA pundit Steve Bannon, often voicing his criticism of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
How in the world does Zelensky have leverage of this type when he's not an elected leader right now? There's no democracy in Ukraine. And then we got over $300 billion going there. And MGT and everybody's been asking for an audit. We can't get an audit of our own money, $300 billion spent of American funding for Ukraine and the war, and we don't know where the money went.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says he'll have no problem working with David Bratt if the US Senate confirms his appointment as ambassador.
I'll work with whoever is determined to be the ambassador. That is a decision for the United States.
The United States hasn't had an ambassador in Australia since Caroline Kennedy finished her time in the role at the end of 2024.
David Sparks there. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Rachel Mealy. The podcast of the full PM program is available on ABC Listen. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow night. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump had taken his seat at the White House Correspondents' Dinner not long before a 31-year-old tried to burst in, armed with guns and knives. Today we speak to Missy Ryan, staff writer at The Atlantic, who was in the room, about the security failings and Trump's response. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.